Welcome to Influential She, the podcast about accelerating the influence of women in the world.
You will find us to be a fresh voice in an old conversation.
And here we are, your amazing co-hosts, Deb Soholt
and Mel Schopp. Well, welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Influential She. We are the go-to voice for accelerating women's influence. We're thrilled to have you here today. I'm your co-host, Mel Schopp.
And I'm Deb Soholt. And we're today with a wonderful guest talking about the high leverage practice of connection. And, you know, Mel, you and I have talked quite a bit about this is not just about running around a room, meeting people in just a face-to-face way, quickly forgetting their name. This is about having connections that can really accelerate influence because we are connecting with people, even those we don't like, but we are connecting with an intentionality that says, I see you and I hear you.
And when you have that true connection, we learned this, and I certainly learned this early on in my work and in my career, is that it requires that I really add value to the people who are there in the room with me. It's more than just, as we would say, passing out business cards. It's really about that reciprocal respect and making sure that we give the air that we care about the people we're connecting with, because that's how true influence can be grown.
Absolutely. And we have a wonderful guest today, a very prestigious guest with us today, who I'm just really excited about. I've had the opportunity to get to know her well through some national health innovation work that we're doing as state senators together. And I want to introduce to you Senator Elizabeth Steiner Hayward. She is from Oregon. We're just so glad that you joined us today. And the other interesting thing about the senator is she's not only in that role, but she is also a family medicine physician. So here we've got a woman who has charted new ground, making connections, being a physician. And we're going to have her talk about that a little bit, and then translated that physician work into being a state senator, which is somewhat rare air. Yes, there are physicians that have run for public positions such as this, but the demands of coexistence between being a physician and being a senator or representative are very great, and she has been able to traverse that ground. So Elizabeth, why don't you start with, I know that you were involved in teaching in the family medicine practice program, but how did you end up moving and making connections that brought you to this public policy role?
It's a little bit of a long story, and I'll try to keep it brief, but it's really relevant to our conversation today. One of the reasons I love family medicine is because I love having these really deep, long-lasting connections with patients, getting to know them as whole people. When you do that, and when you really dig into people's life stories, you realize that there's more to health than what just happens in the traditional healthcare setting. And you know this as a nurse, right? We see things that influence people's health. And what I realized was at one point that legislators in the state didn't really understand that healthcare was that having a healthy population was much bigger than just having a robust healthcare system. And even then, the system that we had wasn't really working to serve people in the right ways. So way back in 2002, there was a ballot measure in Oregon to create a universal healthcare program, which in theory sounded like a great idea, but it wasn't really well designed. And the proponents didn't even come to the family doctors, who serve more people in this state than any other kind of doctor, until well after it qualified for the ballot. And that was because all the influence in Salem, all the connections in Salem on behalf of medicine had been formed by subspecialists, not by primary care doctors like me. So I went to the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians, which is my specialty organization, and said, hey, we're not serving our patients well. We're not providing the kind of influence in Salem to get them the kind of care they deserve. So back in 2003, I started spending a lot of time in Salem building those relationships with legislators across the entire spectrum, trying to help them understand how their constituents, our patients, would be better served by redesigning the system. And eventually, it got to the point where people started to encourage me to run too. And that's because I'd built the connections, because I'd gotten to know people. And so when an opportunity came up, which is a whole other interesting story about women's roles, but when an opportunity came up, I went for it. And thanks to those connections I had built, I won appointment to a vacant Senate seat almost 9 years ago now.
So Elizabeth, I think this is just a really classic example of the power of connection. I mean, you brought that up a number of times throughout the story that you just gave. So, you know, you talked about it within your practice, but you also talked about it legislatively. Can you explain some of the things you've been able to do because of those strong connections and how that's really helped you to be a strong, influential woman in both spheres?
I think one of the most important things when you talk about connection and not just being really brief interactions, it's about more listening than talking. It's about asking questions so that you can really understand who a person is, what their values are, what their goals are. And that's something that I've tried to do throughout my career in both medicine and as a legislator. And by doing that, by really forming these connections, by asking these questions, you can often find places where you overlap with other legislators, even people that you might traditionally think you don't have a lot in common with. I'm from an urban area and rural legislators. I'm a woman. A lot of them are men. I'm a Democrat. They're Republicans. And yet I work so closely with a lot of them because we've built these really genuine relationships. And that's let me get really strong public health policy legislation. Like, we passed a statewide universally offered home visiting program for new moms and babies last year on a bipartisan basis because I'd worked really hard to frame it in a way that made it clear that it could meet lots of different people's goals.
So, Elizabeth, you talk about working with people that are not all that easy to work with. And we've talked about this a lot in how we connect with other people, because sure, it's easy to hang out with those people that philosophically agree with you, that, you know, you're all kind of moving in the same direction, even if you somewhat disagree, but you're basically on the same page. And you spoke about hanging out with people and really starting to move with people on a connection where there is some negotiation space. Can you talk a little bit about some of the skills you've developed doing that kind of work? Because I think that's where women struggle sometimes, women and men can struggle in their relationship building.
One of the challenges I think a lot of us face is making assumptions about other people and assuming that because they have several positions that are different than ours or different values, different ideals, that means that we're automatically going to disagree about everything. And that's almost never the case. And my experience suggests and has proven really that spending the time to really get to know someone as a whole person, to get to know about their family, to get to know what drove them to get into politics or advocacy, to understand what do they think is going to make them feel like they're a successful legislator? What do they worry about for their constituents? You can often find places where there's more overlap. And when you find those places, and you can even find a small thing you can work on together, then that lets you build over time into bigger and bigger things that you can work on together. And I think one of the challenges is understanding that you may not be able to do the big stuff right away, that you have to lay really solid foundations first. And sometimes you get lucky and you can pass something really big right away. I mean, that universally offered home visiting program, which I really do think is going to be one of the highlights of my legislative career in terms of its transformative potential, I wasn't sure we'd get it through in 2019. It was the first time I'd run it. It was a big idea. I'd done a lot of groundwork and I won't say I got lucky. I worked my tail off and my team worked their tail off. But we got through. But other times you have to take step by step by step. And that's let us get to some places where we get some really major work done with a lot of consensus from people who don't normally agree because they trust me, because I've built that trust and they know I tell them the truth. They know that I respect them for their differences with me and for our similarities.
Your story just reminds me so much of the work that Deb did in the legislature. So I have to brag a little bit about my business partner who really built a lot of the work she did as well on building that reciprocal respect. In fact, I think the two of us can look back at the work we did with our the teacher pay and, you know, the reform of the state aid formula. And it took that same sort of work, Elizabeth. So you just, you know, I kind of got goosebumps when you were talking about how you work through that process of making sure it isn't just, this is my idea and this is how I'm coming forward. But you obviously have used that to to the good of things and the work that you've done legislatively, for sure, and also within your practice. What about personally? How has that played out in your life throughout all the pieces that you've done in building those respectful relationships?
Well, you know, sometimes it's easier to do stuff in a professional environment than in a personal environment. But I am blessed with, I actually just had lunch, socially distanced, carefully arranged lunch with a very old friend of mine, a woman I got to know actually when we were in a mother's group together when our oldest children were newborns, which is almost 25 years ago now. And we were talking about that, and I was saying that I just moved about two months ago, and I was saying that when we can finally have a bunch of people together, there are about 10 women I'm going to have over as my first big social gathering to thank them for helping me through a rocky couple of years in my life, both personally and professionally. I'm blessed with three amazing daughters, one of whom came as part of a package deal when I got married a long time ago. And she and I have a great relationship. And then I gave birth to two more. And I'm really fortunate about that. Unfortunately, their dad and I are separated and are on the verge of getting divorced. And, you know, I think it's in large part because there really wasn't a genuine connection between us anymore. And because, you know, I have mentioned in my conversation about how I connect with others is try to understand who they really are as whole people. And the more I thought about it and the more I talked with my dear friends who know me well, and in fact, my daughters, they helped me understand that I was not being true to myself in the context of this marriage. And that if I were going to be myself in the long term and be true to who I really am, that I couldn't do that and stay married. And ultimately, I made that difficult decision about a year and a half ago. And, you know, it's been, thank God, largely amicable. We're both adults, but it's sad. I'm not going to say it's not sad. But the good news is our daughters are doing great. And those connections are really, really strong. And I have this incredible group of women friends who've really gotten me through some tough times at work and some tough times on my in my personal life. And that's a real blessing.
Wow, Elizabeth, for you to share that kind of vulnerability, everyone, is just, especially in its raw state for you, is really an incredible gift, because so many times people could perceive that all of this business of accelerating influence, of leveraging influence in the world, of doing good in the world is just, when you hear stories about it, it's just so easy for everybody and everything goes perfect and like nobody's human. Like we could look on the outside of that and just, you know, make some real assumptions about that. And for you to share the very human side, and I agree with you, sometimes that whole professional side can be so much easier than the personal side. You know, it's just the... One time I heard this fabulous quote. I was at a conference and they were talking about chronicity and health. And she said, daily living is just so daily, but it's pervasive. Mm-hmm. And that has just always stuck with me, how mm-hmm. if that daily living and the connection with how you are with your daily life is not truly resonating with who your authentic self is, it is so pervasive and so ongoing. And that's part of how we encourage women to assess their lives, just as you had to do, to say, am I on most levels, do I sing? You know, am I living my true authentic self? Because people can feel that when you start to move away from who you are.
Exactly. I remember reading, has either of you ever read this book called Finding Your Own North Star?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a great book. And what I love about it is this concept that we all have our own personal magnetic north. And just like a compass needle, when we're turned away from that magnetic north, when we're turned away from our true selves, that we feel that and we feel sort of twisted internally. And you have to figure out where your true north is and go toward that and take who you are as a whole person and try to be as integrated as possible.
I remember one of the things that I took from that I have this written down in something is about nurturing your intuition. Mm-hmm. Because I think about as females that we have this really strong intuition that sometimes we don't nurture at all. And so I think that idea of, you know, nurturing the intuition and really taking what we know is right and moving forward, that is a really powerful thing. So I'm glad you brought that up, Elizabeth, because I think that's pretty critical.
It really stuck with me.
You know, Elizabeth, one of the things in knowing you, you've talked to me many times about how you have a deep connection with your faith.
Oh, yeah.
And that is something that really has guided you in how you make your way in the world. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Thanks for asking about that, because it is really important to me. I'm Jewish, and I would say that in the early part of my life, I wasn't super engaged, but starting in high school, getting involved with other Jewish kids as part of a youth group, and then through college and in all of my life since then, and learning more and more about the teachings of Judaism and fully integrating them. One of the most important teachings in Judaism is this concept called Tikkun Olam, which means, literally, it means sort of repairing the world. But the concept is that God wants us to be God's partners in making the world a better place. And one of the ways we can do that is to identify the talents that we've been given, whether you want to say that's by nature or by God or however you want to frame it, whatever works for you, but identify our true talents and figure out how do we use those to serve other people. And again, I think that's part of that North Star concept. So for me, being a connector, being a lifelong learner, being a good listener and communicator, those are all things that I can use both as a physician and a legislator to make the world a little bit of a better place, to make it better, certainly for initially my patients or the medical community, or now I hope my whole state, by making us a little healthier, a little happier, a little better educated, a little more grounded, doing all those things that let me be part of the partnership with God in repairing the world and perfecting the world. And it's never going to be perfect, right? We just read a portion from Deuteronomy a week and a half ago, I think, in synagogue about where in one sentence they say, well, if you follow all these laws, there will never be any poor people. And then literally about four sentences later, it says, and when there are poor people, you shouldn't, you know, you should make sure that you're generous to them. And you think, what the heck? What is this, right? And the point is, there's sort of an ideal world, and then there's the reality. And we all know that. And we can dream about what the ideal world would look like. And we can use that dream, that vision, to help motivate us and help us work toward it. And also be pragmatic and recognize it's sort of like Zeno's paradox. You're never going to get completely there. You're always going to take another step and cut the distance in half and cut the distance in half, but you're never really going to get there. But that's okay, because we're getting closer and closer.
And I'm thinking this and wondering this about you, as well as I'm sure our listeners would be. You have this amazing, really intense career, and you're also in the legislature. How do you balance this? How do you make this work?
Well, I think it's like anything else in life. You know, at different points in your life, different parts of your life take precedence. And right now, for example, I'm not practicing medicine very much. I'm doing a little bit of teaching. Mm-hmm. I'm doing a little consulting with some small private schools to talk with them about how to manage COVID, all that kind of stuff. But I'm not seeing patients. And that's partly because of my own health issues and sort of trying to keep myself safe, and partly because my legislative work's really important and I need to focus on that. And I moved 2.5 months ago and I'm trying to set up my new life. And I'm trying to finalize my divorce, and I have children I'm trying to help through this pandemic and crisis. And so part of it's also about being realistic and learning when to say no, right? I think as women, especially really active, accomplished women, it can be really hard to say no.
Exactly.
And what I've learned, I have a new method, or it's not so new anymore. I've been doing it for a while. When someone asks me to do something that either I'm not really crazy about doing, or I truly don't think I have the bandwidth for, I'll say to them, I'm really honored you asked me to do that, and I'm going to have to say no because I don't have the bandwidth to do it well. And you deserve to have this done well. And if I can't make you a promise that I know I can keep to do it well, then I'm going to say no. And thank you for understanding.
That's great advice.
That's great advice.
Wow.
I can think of something right now I need to use that line for.
There you go. Have at it. Steal away. because it's true, right? I mean, we're always asked really accomplished women, right? You want to get something done, ask somebody who's really busy. You want to say yes. You want to have, you're honored that someone recognized your competence. And yet knowing that you're not doing something well is really stressful and it makes you feel icky inside. And it's better to say no up front and be honest with people, and they'll respect you for it too.
You know, Elizabeth, you brought up talking about, you know, just COVID, both in the professional life and, you know, helping your daughters navigate this new world and kind of where we're at. Talk just a little bit about your perspective on just some things that we have to now face in our world based on a pandemic, some of the new things that we're thinking about in policy, your lens of being a doctor. What are some of the things that you're thinking about in how, as people, we have to learn to connect together?
You know, I'm always a glass half full person. I'm an eternal optimist. And I really think there are a lot of blessings in this pandemic. Sure, there are a lot of really awful things, and I'm not trying to minimize those. But let's focus for a minute on the blessings. I think one of the blessings is letting us see, really see, how fragile our communities really are and recognizing how we have to come together to change that and to recognize when people are living on the edge and why they might be living on the edge and what we can do to change our systems, to really think about policies that help put buffers in place, that help protect people who are more vulnerable, that help overcome past injustices, regardless of people's faith or the color of their skin or whatever. If we're not providing great education, for example, for every child in our country, regardless of where they live, regardless of how wealthy or poor their community is, then we're not really setting people up for success down the road, right? And we see that now. We see how vulnerable people who don't have a good education are. And whether that's really, really poor people in Appalachia or really, really poor people in inner city Chicago, it doesn't matter. We have an obligation, we have a moral obligation. And we're seeing that need so clearly now. And I think we're also, some people at least, I think are trying to use this as an opportunity to put aside some of the differences, to circle back to some of our conversation earlier, to find those points of similarity, to find those shared goals of service, of helping everybody rise to their fullest potential. So I'm hopeful, maybe because I'm eternally hopeful, but I am hopeful that this crisis will result in some changes, will result in people like you and me, Deb, legislators who are in this for exactly the right reasons, to make our communities better, to make our communities stronger and more resilient, to help create a rising tide that does lift every boat. We'll see this as an opportunity to change policies. I heard this great thing on I read this great article the other day about Cincinnati. And in Cincinnati, they had the problem that a lot of places have where if you want to rent a new apartment, not only do you have to put down first and last rent, but you also have to put down a security deposit. And often coming up with all of that cash up front is a huge barrier to people to get into housing, right? We've all seen this. Cincinnati came up with an ordinance that said, okay, landlords deserve to be protected and the security deposit shouldn't be a barrier. So you can pay the security deposit up front. You can set up a payment plan over 3 to 6 months, or you can pay into an insurance program for the entire time you live in a place of $5 a month or whatever, and it's a big pool, and the landlords are protected from if you cause damage in the apartment, but you only have to come up with an extra $5 a month. And it's so creative, right? Because it's protecting mm-hmm. everybody. And if we can start to think creatively like that about how do we help all of the people, we're not trying to necessarily disadvantage one group to increase advantages to another. We're just trying to level the playing field a little bit more.
I think, Elizabeth, you're talking about how we can look to accelerate influence by saying, all right, let's rise above what this current situation is, kind of flip it on its head, mm-hmm. start to look at it in a different creative way. Mm-hmm. And how can we create an outcome or a solution or a moving forward together that isn't disparate for one group or another?
Right.
That, okay, maybe it hurts just a little bit for all of us equally, or we're going to have process pain on how we're going to get there. But I think right now, to your optimistic point, this is really a great time to start scanning the universe and seeing who do we need to connect with as women that want to leverage influence? Because we can see this collective humanity. I mean, that's part of who we are as women, as our biology makes us look at it this way, the logic and the feeling of what is happening, and then to start moving forward instead of being paralyzed right now.
Right, exactly.
Of course, I'm in the education space, and we keep talking about this new normal. But I think what's fascinating, it's to your point, Elizabeth, that this new normal, or that, you know, we're yearning for when we go back to normal, which probably had some gaps and holes in it that were not always positive. It's forcing us to think differently. It's doing exactly what you said, where it's really shining a spotlight on disparities we have between the have and have nots, and then making us think creatively about how to address that. And the interesting part about it is they've always been there, but it's forcing us to do something about it. So I think that your comment about how, you know, if we look at it with this glass half full, the potential we have in moving things forward in probably a better way, it will be really interesting to be able to look in retrospect and realize that, you know, this new normal, whatever it's going to be like, is probably the way that we should have been pushing ourselves before. We just didn't have to. You know, we've been comfortable, so comfortable.
Exactly.
Elizabeth, a little bit earlier on, you were talking about, just some of the difficulties of moving forward into the state Senate as a woman, and that sometimes there are some differences when there is a large number of men. I know I've experienced that in my own state.
Oh, sure.
Not that the men were not great or good, but just some of the new ways of needing to connect by just simply by being female, because I didn't match what was kind of the normal, if you will, within what the makeup was. Talk a little bit about that for you, and what advice would you give women?
So I'm sighing because that's such a hard question.
It was such a good sigh too.
Yeah, I'm notorious for good sighs. It's a good question because really, and this is I've been reading a lot lately, and I think it's relevant for women versus men. It's relevant for Black people versus white people. What's the norm? And who should fit into it? And should there be one norm, right? Because one of the challenges that women have when we're operating in traditionally male, predominantly male environments is that the norm is what men do and how men behave. So are women obligated to adapt and change how we behave to fit men's expectations? Or are we obligated to find ways to change expectations and help people understand, to some extent, apropos of what we were just talking about, that the new normal is that there are a lot of different normal ways to behave. And I think we see this in politics all the time, right? Women who are assertive, who ask tough questions, who are intelligent and demonstrate that intelligence, are seen as aggressive and witchy, since I'm going to assume that this is a G-rated podcast.
There you go.
You can say bitchy on this show,
cool.
Elizabeth.
All right. We're seen as aggressive and bitchy, and like we have to prove that we're the smartest person in the room or that we talk too much. We have people steal our ideas because people don't listen to women, and then men say the same thing, and then they're the ones who have the good idea.
We've heard this before, Deb.
We have talked about that.
Yeah. Speaking to our hearts.
Yeah, exactly. And I would argue pretty strongly that it's long past time women started changing what the norm was and started challenging those expectations. There are a lot of ways we can do it, right? I mean, you know, you've probably talked on this podcast about the technique of amplification. We're in a meeting together, the three of us are in a meeting together, and there's seven or eight men in the room, and there's three of us, and one of the women says something, and one of us says something that's a good idea. The other two of us need to jump in right away and say, you know, just as Deb said, I think da da da, and repeat what Deb said and give her credit for it, right? As opposed to assuming that people heard what Deb said and we're actually internalizing it, because we have to say this stuff over and over again, right? We have to practice this technique of amplification to be heard. And that's unfortunate, but it's true. And we have to do everything we can to make it clear that we have just as much right and obligation to ask those tough questions, to use our intelligence in service to others, just the way men are doing. And it's a long, slow process. And I have to believe that it's exactly what our Black friends are trying to deal with now, trying to change norms about what it means to be. You don't have to act like a white person to be a really high functioning, intelligent person, right? You can act however it is, but there isn't one normal. White culture isn't the only culture. Male culture isn't the only culture. There are a lot of equally valid cultures, and we have to play a role in changing that conversation.
You know, Elizabeth, coming back to your North Star quote, that, you know, if you turn away from your own authentic North Star and that disconnect feeling you start having, it's the same disconnect if you're trying to fit into someone else's worldview that mm-hmm. does not fit who you are authentically.
Right.
And so we've talked to women a lot about the sooner you can figure out who you are and starting to make your own decisions and navigate your way through the world based on who you are, the faster you're going to be influential. Because trying to become something you're not, fit into something you're not, act like something you're not, just moves you away. And then I think that disconnect of speaking from your own truth and how people hear you, if you're speaking from your own truth and someone doesn't like it, you can say, okay, well, we disagree, you don't like it, but that is who I am. Mm-hmm. To yourself, you can look in the mirror, but if you're trying to act out of someone else's script or right. what you think you should be in relationship to someone else, it moves you further and further away from really being influential.
So I think there's another piece that's really useful here. The other thing that really stuck with me from that same book, from Martha Beck's book about North Stars, is this. There's an exercise in there to think about who are the they in your life, right? Well, mm-hmm. I can't do that because they won't like it, or they really expect me to do this, right? Who are those they people? Can you have conversations with them to figure out, can you really identify them, or is it some nameless, shapeless, societal blob of expectation? And then if you can figure out specific people, can you have conversations with them to figure out if that's what they really do expect of you? Because more often than not, it's a fake construct that we made up in our own heads, and that it's keeping us from being our authentic selves because we have this desire to conform to what we believe are other people's expectations, but that may be totally false.
Elizabeth, I just a couple things, and I was going to jump in on the previous conversation you had as well, because what you just said is so really true. We call it the othering, you know, where we mm-hmm. other everything else and put yep. everything into buckets. It keeps us safe when we can use othering instead of just pointing to specific individuals. But as you were talking also about how we speak, one of the phrases we have used frequently, and I know that both of us have examples of when we were in conversations in the legislature, I in the role of more of lobbying and for the education world, and Deb in her role as a legislator, was that a lot of times women were tempted to raise their voices, and we always encourage them, raise your words instead. And finding the words that you can use that are going to make the impact instead of thinking that we have to speak louder or that we have to use a different persona to be in that space, that I think is exactly what you're talking about. You really gave some powerful advice there. So speaking of advice, I mean, I hate to have this conversation end. It's been so, so powerful. But I would just be really curious, Elizabeth, if you could give words of advice for women who are looking to increase their influence based on your past in connection, but in whatever other ways, what would you tell women? What would you tell somebody today if you could tell your 30-year-old something, what would you tell her today?
Figure out who you really are. Figure out what your values are, what your belief structures are, what your overarching view of the world is. Doesn't mean it can't shift over time, but figure out where you are right now. Figure out what your true underlying strengths are. And by that, I mean sort of the meta skills of connection or communication or what, and then what jazzes you up. Well, me, for example, I'm a lifelong learner. I get bored super easily. So I have to be in an environment where I'm learning all the time. And so figure out who you truly are, what your true meta skills are, and then figure out where are environments where you can find a place where you can take all those skills, all those talents that you have, and use them to help realize your true values. And as we've said, well, if you say something that's true to who you really are and people don't agree with you, okay, cool. But if you're saying something and it's not really true to who you are, you're certainly not going to be effective, because people can sort of tell. It's like, what do they say now, even this era of COVID or with a mask on? Smile anyway, because even if people can't see it, they can hear it in your voice, right? People can hear it when you're not being authentic, when you're not exactly being true to yourself. And they may not know it on a conscious level, but they can feel it on a subconscious level, and you can feel it. So be true to who you, figure out who you really are, be true to that person, and then use all of those strengths to help yourself and the people around you move forward in the world.
Wow. That's just such incredible advice for our listeners, Elizabeth. And just in knowing you, I know our listeners can feel your sincerity just coming through in your voice, and how you are a magnet for others, and how we became friends through this legislative work just because of who you are, and getting to know you and feeling the authentic you in the room, and how we have been in conversation about helping to make the world a better place as policymakers. And I also know when you talk about your lifelong learning, one of those lifelong learnings for you includes learning to do a handstand. Is that not right?
Yeah, it's taken me a while. My headstand's not bad now, but the handstand's taking a while.
It's like totally incredible. Wow. Watching her videos on how she's moving forward in just like the boss woman and doing this handstand. Yeah, I'm telling you, she is multifaceted in her talents. So
I need goals. I just need goals, right? Because, you know, working out is fine for itself, and I feel stronger, but having a goal to be able to do something like that, even if I don't quite get there, and I think I will eventually, but even if I don't, I'll feel like, okay, I have something I'm working toward, and that's always a good thing.
Wow.
You've inspired me. A new inspiration.
Yeah, I know. It's like, here we go. Don't even think about it, Melody. Because then I'll feel like I have to try, and I just can't even imagine how that would go.
That's a new challenge for us.
A new challenge for Influential She. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Senator Dr. Elizabeth. We just so appreciate you being on our show and for sharing your insights and all of the amazing things that you're doing in connection with other people that is not only just thinking about making the world a better place, but actually seeing the outcome of having it happen. You're just truly incredible. Thanks for being on our show.
I'm really grateful for the opportunity. It's a real pleasure talking with both of you. And I'm really glad to hopefully be helpful to other women.
Thank you so much.
And to everybody who listened in on this podcast for Influential She, we just really appreciate that you did it. And we like to leave you with a question at the end of our shows. And so one of the things I've been thinking about as Elizabeth has been talking is, where are you at in your connections with others? Are there situations that you feel like you could shore up that would increase your influence? Are there people that maybe you should circle back with, reconnect, and start to sort out how could you develop a meaningful connection to link arms and do amazing things? Thanks so much, everyone, for tuning in to another episode of Influential She. We hope you'll do it again.
Thanks for tuning in. If you enjoyed our podcast, we'd be so jazzed if you rate us on whatever app you use to find us. And hey, be sure to tell all your friends about Influential She.
And please visit us at InfluentialShe.com and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn. And you know what? If you come up with a new one, please let us know. In the meantime, remember, stay influential.